What works in combating opioid addiction? Addiction to opioids, including heroin and certain prescription pain relievers, is a public health crisis in Maine. The number of people seeking treatment in the state has skyrocketed from about 1,100 in 2010 to nearly 3,500 in 2014. Hospitals are seeing related problems such as drug-addicted babies and more hepatitis C cases, and people are dying. Maine saw 272 drug overdose deaths last year, a 31% increase over 2014. Experts attribute the rise to a doubling of heroin-related deaths. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with experts in the field about what works in helping those addicted to heroin, fentanyl, and other opioids recover. It's called medication-assisted treatment. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The rapid rise in the abuse of opiates has reached crisis levels both here in Maine and across the country. Everyone from legislators to doctors are trying to find the best ways to combat the crisis. One way that medical experts believe is the best option for opiate addicts is medication-assisted treatment. We'll talk about what that is and how it's working in Maine. With me in our studio, Dr. Mark Publicker. He's an addiction treatment specialist in private practice, and he is past president of the Northern New England Society of Addiction Medicine. Amanda is a mother who's recovering from an opiate addiction. Dr. Jennifer Smith is with North Bridgeton Family Practice. What? She treats patients who are addicted to opiates. And Catherine Bell is executive director of Crooked River Counseling in Bridgeton. She provides therapy for those struggling with addiction. Thank you all for joining us today. As always, we want to hear from you and the audience. Do you have questions concerning opiate abuse? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Publicker, I'm going to start with you. If you could just give me just sort of a primer. We've heard about opioids and opiates so often, but I think a lot of people are still confused about what that actually means. Am I right in saying this is a drug, whether it's an illegal drug or a prescription drug that is derived from the poppy plant, that is derived from opium?
Yes, I think essentially that's a good way to describe it. So opioids are naturally occurring in the opium plant. About 200 years ago, it was found that opium was a very effective medicine for treatment of pain. In the 19th century, that was synthesized into morphine. If you think about what pain was like before we had opium or morphine, it was quite different. What happened over the course of the last century or so was drug companies, Bayer, that produced aspirin, produced heroin about 1898. And
so in 1898, you could buy heroin over the counter.
The advertisements were aspirin on one side of the ad and heroin on the other. And it was advertised as an essentially non-addictive cough medicine. Addiction exploded in the early part of the 20th century as a consequence. But opiates themselves, opium, opioids, these are medicines that plug into the brain's opioid system. It's naturally occurring. Opioids are important to many normal functions of our brain. They function to help regulate mood, help regulate reward and pleasure, and also help regulate even the immune function of the body. So opioids are important, they're natural, they're found receptors all throughout the brain. Opioid medications plug in and activate these in proper amounts. They activate in a way that produces desirable effects. Often, however, in larger doses or for some individuals who have a genetic predisposition to problems, a cascade occurs. The pursuit of getting a positive effect changes until instead of seeking pleasure, basically the use is to avoid the pain that occurs in the course of developing an addiction.
Jennifer Smith, I wanted to ask you about the kind of guidance that you as a doctor have gotten about these prescription medicines that are opioids. How has it changed? I'm looking at you. I know you haven't been a doctor for 50 years, but in the time you've been working with patients in Maine, how is the advice that you've been given as far as prescription medication, especially opiates, changed over the years?
Sure. I think I've been in practice for about 10 years now, and I think, thinking about residency training, we didn't get a whole lot of training in how to maybe safely prescribe these medications or talking to patients about the risks and benefits and maybe alternate sort of medications. We were kind of taught to treat to the pain scale, and you treated a patient until they had little or no pain, and that didn't always make them very functional, maybe a lot of side effects, but that was kind of how we were trained to treat pain.
So that was really the sort of the dominant paradigm 15 years ago.
Sure.
You know, if someone comes to you in pain, give them one of these prescription pain medications because pain is to be taken seriously and we want to relieve that pain.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, there was a lot of litigation about patients not treating or declining to treat patients in pain. And so that was always a fear.
And Dr. Publicker, you say that that was the beginning of the real problem.
There was no question back in the 1990s, early 2000s, major medical associations were pushing physicians to use opioids for non-cancer pain. Physicians were put in a position, as Jennifer said, where it was seen as a failing. It was negligent not to give patients as much of opiate medications as the patients said they needed. Now we're in the situation where patients often are on hundreds of milligrams of very potent opioids. And unfortunately, physicians are being blamed for the problem. And while everybody may have some culpability, major medical associations really help to create and initiate the problem.
Catherine Bell, one of the reasons we wanted to do this program today is because there's so much bad news about the opiate epidemic, and rightly so. I mean, we are seeing nearly 300 people in Maine died last year. But it's not all bad news, right? There is some reason to believe that people who are addicted can get meaningful help in Maine.
Yes, and I really was hoping that there would, that we could give a message of hope that there is treatment that is working. You know, there are doctors that are willing to treat opiate addiction with medication that is very helpful to them. And it would be really nice for people to not just hear, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough doctors, we don't have enough treatment providers. But, there is hope that there is something that is working.
How many people do you work with who have an addiction?
I have a caseload of about 30 clients.
And do you find that, do you believe and do you have confidence that 30 of them will be able to recover from their addiction?
I really don't know how to answer that question. I think it is definitely a lifelong process for them. And there are a lot of different factors in their recovery that have to be taken into consideration. It is a chronic relapsing condition, but if they're willing to, work with a team of providers, I'm very fortunate that I have a team of providers that I work with. And if they're willing to work with a team of providers, I think they have an excellent chance.
All right, Amanda, I want to bring you into the conversation. Thank you so much for coming today and being willing to share your story. How did you find yourself addicted to opiates? Was it through a prescription painkiller or was it through illegal drugs?
It started with prescription drugs, which were illegal because I was buying them off the street. But it progressed very fast for me because it was never, ever enough. So then that's when I started using heroin.
How old were you when you started?
The first time I used heroin, I was 17.
Oh, my goodness. And how long would you consider yourself an addict?
Well, I think that we all, or some of us are born with that predisposition, genetics. But so I think that I have been an addict my whole life. And I remember the first day that I thought about it, actually, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know why I couldn't stop. So I do think I was born with that, but it was a different day that I realized it.
How old were you when you decided to seek help, and how did you go about seeking that help in Maine?
I was actually 19 when I wanted to get off opiates. The person that I was dating at the time, his mother had gone to Mercy Recovery, and she referred me there, and I went. I went through detox there 5 days, which was, I thought at the time, was the worst 5 days of my life. And they did put me on Suboxone, which people can abuse that, yes, but it saved my life. I've never abused it. I've always taken it the right way. And the longer I stay sober, the more I can feel, it's almost like I can feel parts of my brain healing, because I start to think of these things and feel these things that I never felt, and I know how to deal with them. And I mean, I never thought I'd even be sitting here talking to you about it. It's amazing.
So your therapy has been what we're going to talk about today, medically assisted treatment, a combination of Suboxone and therapy. How long ago did you begin? You said you were 19. How old are you now?
And 26.
26. So for 7 years. And how does that work now? Do you still use Suboxone, or do you wean off of it, or what could someone expect?
I know people that have tapered off of it. I know people that have tapered off of it and started using it again. I don't know if I'll ever stop taking it. I'm not at that place yet. I think I'll know when I'm ready. I'll be able to say 100% that I will never, ever, ever touch opiates again. That's how I feel. But if I do have to stay on it the rest of my life, I don't think that that's a problem.
And one more question. We'll come back to you later, Amanda. But if someone's listening to this program and they have a loved one who is, they're very worried about, what would you tell that person?
That's so hard, because I've been through that too. I lost my brother, and there's not a lot you can say, but there, I feel like I'm an example of how it can turn out if you hang in there. And I mean, of course, offer the help and be supportive. The last thing that I think anybody should do is turn their back on someone because they're an addict. And I feel like a lot of people think that that's how it's supposed to be, because there's still a stigma on addicts. But, you know, I think about how to explain this to my daughter all the time, and I just feel like it is a disease. Addicts are sick, but there is treatment, there is help, and it can get better.
And your daughter is 8 months old now.
Well, that's my son. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old daughter.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, wow. And they're both doing fine.
Oh, yeah. They're all amazing, brilliant kids.
Great. Dr. Publicker, let's talk about Suboxone. What is it? And there's also methadone, correct?
Yes.
Those are the two primary ways to use that are used in the medically assisted treatment. Explain what they are and why they work.
We can start with Suboxone, and the base drug is buprenorphine. Unlike opioids like heroin, like oxycodone, buprenorphine is an unusual drug. It's only a partial opioid. It partially activates the brain's opioid receptor rather than fully activates it. It activates it in a way to beautifully stop opiate withdrawal, almost on a dime. It very successfully blocks craving for opioids. It has a long duration of action. A single dose will last 24 hours. It can produce an opioid withdrawal if it's abruptly stopped, but it produces less physical dependence than other opioids. And probably most importantly, it has the strongest attachment to the brain's opioid receptor, stronger than any other opioid. So if somebody is on it, they have less craving, they're not in withdrawal, they're functioning well. As Amanda will say, people taking it report that they feel normal. If there's a situation in which they slip, the strength of the receptor connection is such that any other opioid can't plug in, can't work. So a slip doesn't result in a catastrophic loss of control.
So, Amanda, this prevents your cravings, but it doesn't make you high.
Absolutely. I haven't craved opiates in 7 years. I tell so many people that because I think it's unbelievable. I never, ever thought, I didn't even know what Suboxone was when they put me on it. I mean, I read about it a little bit, but I didn't know. But yeah, I don't get high on it, obviously, and I haven't craved heroin. I mean, I feel like if I were going to start using heroin again, it would be now because it's everywhere. That's all I hear about. But I don't even, it's like I want to help these people now. I could be right in front of it and not touch it.
Mm. Jennifer Smith, you're a primary care physician, and I understand that you are one of the few primary care physicians willing to take this on, take on addicts and work with them. Why is that? Is there a systemic issue that makes it difficult for primary care docs to tackle this? Do primary care docs feel as though they're not well educated enough to do this well? And why did you decide to take this jump?
I think it's a little bit of a fear factor, a fear of getting over that hurdle of being upfront with patients and asking and knowing that you have some referral resources, I think is a big part of it. The training itself is very easy. It's an online 8-hour program. Almost anyone could do it easily in a weekend. It's, you know, I always say that I did that 8-hour training and then I just learned by starting and the patients teach you everything because they know more about Suboxone than you do. So I think it's just getting over that hurdle. And in our community, we now have 4 doctors, you know, out of a relatively small hospital that have gotten trained and are taking patients. I also think our model, doesn't work without Crooked River. So we were fortunate enough to already, you know, have that connection with them. So everyone that comes to our program is already in some sort of counseling program, whether it's an intensive outpatient program or one-on-one counseling. So we firmly believe that Suboxone replacement doesn't work by itself, just the medication. They have to be. It's mandatory for them to be in some sort of program along with the medication.
Is there a financial disincentive for primary care physicians to treat addicts?
No, it's reimbursed just like any other office visit. I probably spend about a quarter of my time per week seeing patients for addiction, some of which are my patients and some that are not.
All right. Well, guess what? We have to take a break, which I can't believe it's already time. We're going to come back and talk about medication-assisted treatment. I'm going to say that wrong until I get it right. Medication-assisted treatment and opioid addiction. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Sillies and Sillies with a Twist in Portland's East End. Open at 11, Wednesday through Friday, 9 on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options. Sillies.com. And Roosevelt Campobello International Park, a legacy of friendship between two great nations. Open May 28th. Details at fdr.net.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Lena Dunham about turning 30, about the end of girls, and how she's bucking the millennial trend and standing by Hillary Clinton.
I don't mind the idea of having somebody who's a member of the establishment, because guess what? The government is an establishment. If all I wanted was a female in the White House, why wouldn't I have been running around behind Sarah Palin fixing her skirts?
Lena Dunham, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock and again Sunday evening at 11. Some recent good news for those of you in the Portland area wanting to listen to our new Maine Public Classical Channel on your FM radio. We've acquired a new FM signal, 104.1 FM, for Portland, serving the Portland, Westbrook, Scarborough, Falmouth, and Cape Elizabeth areas, and beyond. This new FM station officially joins our growing classical network with stations already in Bangor, Waterville, and Freiburg. A reminder that Maine Public Classical is also available statewide with HD radio and online at mpbn.net. For more information, including our updated coverage maps, please visit mpbn.net.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction. With me in our studio, Dr. Jennifer Smith. She is with North Bridgeton Family Practice. Catherine Bell is with Crooked River Counseling in Bridgeton. Amanda is a mother who is recovering from opiate addiction, and Dr. Mark Publicker is an addiction treatment specialist in private practice in Portland. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email, please, to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Publicker, if you look at the newspapers and pay attention to the newscast here on MPBN, there's a lot of coverage of a lack of beds for addicts. And it sounds to me as though doing what Amanda did and going into a treatment facility is not the only way to get the treatment. Is that right? Can this be done on an outpatient basis?
Actually, I think that there's an extremely minimal role for residential treatment. In fact, I think it's a distraction and is actually harmful with limited amount of resources available. It is well established that outpatient treatment, combining medication with good comprehensive outpatient treatment, is a model of care. Unfortunately, I think that the focus and the movement towards residential treatment is actually handicapping and reducing access to care for the most effective treatment model.
And Catherine Bell, I understand that medication-assisted treatment remains controversial. There are those who don't want patients to be using Suboxone or methadone. Can you explain why this controversy remains?
No, I don't understand it at all. I don't understand it. I mean, we have been working with North Bridgeton Family Practice for about 7 years now, and the majority of our patients are opiate addicted. They do require some type of medical intervention, and I've seen so much success. I've seen people get their children back and get a job and go to school and get their license. Honestly, I don't understand why it's controversial.
All right, we're going to go on to the phones now. We're going to start with John calling from... John, are you in York?
Corinth.
Go ahead.
Yes, my concern is that you're labeling all these people as addicts or taking opioids, and I'm a 100% service-connected disabled veteran, and now I'm having difficulty getting opiates because of the addiction problem. And I have several conditions that make me unable to get around from time to time. Last year it was three issues I had, and the longest time was 46 days bedridden in pain and infection. And the thought of not having pain meds available, I think that the problem is going to be that you're going to find people are going to be seeking out more heroin than you guys can deal with.
Well, you know what? When you were talking, everybody on our panel was nodding. This is part of the problem here, isn't it? That people hear how dangerous opiates are, and then they are afraid to, use them. I'll turn to you, Jennifer. Is this an issue you see with patients who actually? You prescribe opioids because they're in pain and they would be useful in their treatment.
Yeah, sure. I don't think any of us are saying that there's not a role for appropriate opioid prescriptions. I think that we're just being much more diligent about making sure it's the right thing, making sure that patient's functional and has other ways of dealing with pain rather than just opioids. We're very conscientious about doing drug screening and making sure patients are filling prescriptions on time and that they're not getting other medications. So I do feel like people that have legitimate prescriptions sometimes feel like they're having to jump through hurdles. And I think what we're really trying to do is just be more responsible about where they're going. And I've had several patients who have just wanted to wean off when we really have that talk about, is this really improving your quality of life? And sometimes for people it's not. It doesn't mean they're addicted. It just means it's not the right thing to be doing. We have a lot of medical research that shows it's probably not the right thing to be doing for the majority of patients that are on opiates.
To Dr. Publicker, in the beginning of the program, you said not everyone will become addicted. Do we have any idea of percentages, what percentage of people who use opioids as prescription painkillers will become addicted?
No, we don't. But it looks like there is a genetic vulnerability that increases the likelihood of opiate addiction. There's a different configuration of the opiate receptor in the brain. People who have that, the first time they take an opioid, are very surprised. They have this extreme sense of euphoria, of stimulation, whereas most of us who are prescribed an opioid post-surgically, I don't know, I think most people are like me, don't like the feeling, find ourselves feeling low-key, feeling ourselves fatigued and maybe dulled in our thinking. So there is a difference in individuals. We're not all alike. It probably is the case that 10% of people have a pure vulnerability, and then there's a bunch of other people who have to work at it. But
so our caller, John, a combat vet who has been treated for years with opioids, he would know by now if he were addicted.
Well, he might know, and of course his doctor and his family might know, and he might not know. Now, John, I'm not speaking about you, of course, but in opiate addiction, there's initially a pursuit of euphoria, of pleasure, but the brain adapts, the brain changes, and it changes negatively. So when people should realize, when people have become opiate addicted, they're not pursuing pleasure. They're trying to escape the pain that the use of the drug is actually causing them.
John, I appreciate your call. I'm going to go on to Thea, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Thea. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. I recognize that there's a problem with a few people, percentage-wise, who do become addicted. But contrary to what Dr. Publicker just said, from what it sounds like to me, not everyone who uses opiates has a euphoric feeling that they need it for pain and they do not become addicted. And unfortunately, these great programs like yours that are talking about an important issue fail to really make a point and make it clear that the majority of people taking opioids do not become addicted and they need the medication.
Okay, Thea, and that actually is what Dr. Publicker, I believe, was just saying. The trick is you don't know going into this which camp you're going to end up in.
Correct.
Okay. Thea, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to an email now. I'm going to be abbreviating this email from Pekka. He's talking about evidence by Dr. Dustin Sulak, he names, of using medical cannabis as a solution to the opioid epidemic. Dr. Publicker, have you followed studies of the use of medical cannabis, also known as medical marijuana, in the treatment of opioid addiction?
Yeah, two points to be made. First, there's actually zero research that would document effectiveness, literally zero. If you do a literature search, you won't find any. And secondly, if cannabis was actually effective, I wouldn't have any patients because virtually 100% of my patients are smoking cannabis simultaneously with using opioids.
Okay, we're going to move on to Laurel, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Laurel. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. Thank you so much. So I would like to have the panelists talk a bit about the ongoing debate in Maine about drug testing people who receive government benefits, such as temporary assistance for needy families. I'm wondering about this for two reasons. First, I've heard that in other states, the rate that they find that people are using drugs on those programs is actually very low. And second of all, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get government benefits, and I would imagine if you're stuck in your addiction, you're not going to jump through those hoops to get the benefits. And I wonder if they're testing for Suboxone.
Okay, Laurel, it's a little. Okay, go ahead, Dr. Parker.
Yeah, it's terrible concept of drug testing. Drug testing is actually very expensive, and the states that have done this have actually demonstrated that it's more costly to go through a program of drug testing than it is actually to identify people who are actually abusing drugs. Secondly, a lot of people are using medications that are legitimately prescribed for legitimate causes. So if you screen positively for a benzodiazepine or for an opioid like oxycodone but are actually being treated appropriately, there'd be no mechanism by which you wouldn't lose your benefits. So the whole concept of it is unfair. Inappropriate and unsuccessful. It can't work.
Laurel, thank you for your call. An email from John in Windham. He says, what outpatient therapies are there to help insured people who are prescribed opioids don't become addicted? Jennifer, I'm going to throw this to you. When you do prescribe someone with an opioid painkiller, what goes with that?
I think, first of all, it's the communication with the patient and understanding that they're going to be taking something that has the potential to have a lot of adverse outcomes. So I think that honesty, I think we do sign patient contracts. Every time a patient refills a medication, we do some random drug screens. We do check the main database that you can see where any other opioid prescriptions are coming from, so you know it's only coming from your office. And then we see if we see anything that gives some red flags, and we pull that patient in and have kind of a heart-to-heart conversation about what's going on.
All right. Amanda, a little bit ago you wanted to jump in, and I didn't see you over there. What would you like to add?
I just wanted to say something about benzos. I know this is, you know, about opiates and everything, but I had been sober from opiates for years, and then when my brother died, I got severely addicted to Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, any of those, and I feel like a lot of people now are seeking them, but I want to say to anybody who's listening, if that's the case in their lives or anyone that they care about, I would find something else to help with the anxiety, because I never thought I could deal with anxiety. I thought I'd be on Xanax forever. And it got to the point where, I mean, I literally ended up wanting to kill myself because of taking benzos. And I don't think that people really think about benzos right now, especially with all the opiates and stuff, you know, going around, but I just want people to think about that. And I try to stress it to so many people that are having a hard time with stress and anxiety, because I feel like if I can get through my stress and anxiety, anybody can.
All right. Catherine, is the story Amanda's telling one that you hear often?
We do. And, you know, because we provide integrated care with, you know, doctors such as Dr. Jen Smith, you know, we have that conversation. It's about safety, you know, for the client. You know, if they're taking a medication that they're buying off the street because they have, you know, anxiety, you know, that's where the integrated care piece comes in, where, you know, we're all communicating with each other and we're talking because, okay, so this is a person who has anxiety, and is there something, you know, that, you know, is there a medication that's not in the benzodiazepine, you know, family? Like, is it a part of, you know, a longstanding depression? What is this? And then we start making plans around relapse prevention plans around that. So it's a matter of safety.
We have an email from Jennifer. She emails to ask, what effects should employers be aware of when they work with employees on Suboxone or methadone?
For people on stable doses of methadone, there's no evidence whatsoever of effects on cognitive functioning or motor functioning. Literature on that is very clear. With buprenorphine, there's absolutely no evidence of any impairment of any functioning whatsoever.
So if your employee is driving a delivery truck or operating a forklift, fine.
Certainly for buprenorphine, I would have no concerns whatsoever, and I think the literature on that is very clear. Physicians certainly can practice medicine while on buprenorphine. We allow nurses to do so as well. With methadone, It's really a matter of dosage and whether or not there's been a change in dosage more recently.
All right. Well, on that note, we are going to take another break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions about opioid addiction and medically assisted treatment.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, handling over 1 million pounds of recyclables daily in Maine through its Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life. Up ahead in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, world affairs and a panel discussion on the global refugee crisis stemming from the Middle East, where the Syrian conflict has grown to become the center of a global humanitarian crisis. Again, that's coming up in just about 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio is hosting a frequency fixer service tomorrow from 7 a.m. through 2 p.m. at our studios in Portland, located at 323 Marginal Way. So, what are we talking about? A bit of fun. We'll fix your car radio presets to both Maine Public Radio and the new 104.1 FM Portland Maine Public Classical Channel. You'll get a complimentary cup of coffee from our partners at Coffee by Design, and we'll give you a copy of our newest radio schedules. Plan to stop by and say hello tomorrow. Grab a cup of coffee and set your car radio up for great listening in the months and years ahead.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Treating Opiate Addiction with Medication-Assisted Treatment. With me in our studio, Dr. Jennifer Smith provides care at North Bridgeton Family Practice. Dr. Mark Publicker is an addiction treatment specialist in private practice. Catherine Bell is with Crooked River Counseling, and Amanda is a mother who is successfully recovering from opiate addiction. Thank you all for being here today for this fantastic conversation. Let's see here. We will go to Miriam, who is calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Miriam. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I am actually a researcher, and I've been doing ethnographic research for 20 years in the field with drug users. And, of course, what you're talking about with the opiate crisis is addiction. Now that we're talking about opioids, you know, there's also other addictions as well. And I just like to mention that we've never actually tried looking at the social environment and doing something about the social context that people that are getting addicted live in. If you think of the way we've been working or addressing the opiate and every other addiction problem, is like having a two-legged stool. We have law enforcement and we have health and medical treatment. And we always go between the two. Sometimes we're more in law enforcement and right now we're looking more at medical treatment. But we never have that third leg that you need to sit on a stool, which is the social environment and actually addressing the social environment and providing funding to address the problems in the social environment, why people start using to begin with and why they relapse. Up to 80% of the people relapse, and we're not looking at the social environment. So I'd like to know what your panel thinks about that.
Well, I'd like to put this question to Amanda, who started using when she was just a teenager. Do you think that there is something to what Miriam's saying? And if you could advise lawmakers about how to change this world that you grew up in to put you less at risk, what would it be?
Honestly, I really don't know because, I mean, I've thought about this a lot and I've talked about it a lot because I used to think the same thing. I really did. But I come from a great family. My mother has always been amazing. My father was in the Coast Guard my whole life. You know, we always had everything. It was like a storybook family. And my mom is always like, how did this happen? You know, my brother died from methadone overdose. And then there was me who was still using. She's always saying, what did I do wrong? And I can't stress enough to her that she, you know, it was nothing she did. Because the environment I grew up in, I never heard anything about addiction. But then again, I have seen, you know, people start using because of their lives, you know, as kids having no mother and father. You know, my husband is an addict, and that's what happened to him. He got into all of it because he had no mother around, and it was, you know, just negative all the time, negative environment. So I think that's a huge part of it, but it's not, you know, everybody's story. It's not all the same. So I don't know what we could do to change it. I really don't, but...
Why do you think you started using? Was it curiosity?
No, it wasn't. It was more, I don't know why, but mental health issues. You know, I think that and addiction goes hand in hand. Because I was always so self-destructive, whether it was, you know, not eating or doing too much of this, and I was prescribed something. So, you know, I took it for years before realizing, oh my God, I can't stop. What's wrong with me? And that's it just took off from there.
Dr. Publicker.
A huge amount of the patients who I treat and have treated come from impoverished backgrounds, very low education levels, poor educational opportunities, poor job opportunities. If I was going to pick, though, one thing that would decrease the risk of drug addiction in the state, it would be protecting our children from sexual abuse. And I think most people who work in the field would say that easily 50% or more boys and girls who become drug addicted have been the victims in childhood of sexual molestation.
Wow, Catherine, is that what you see in your practice?
I would agree with that.
I would say that almost 100%. I think it's close because I work mostly with pregnant moms that are addicted. That's kind of my area that I just enjoy the most. I would say it's almost 100%.
I was being conservative in my 50%.
Yeah.
Wow. And talk about you talked about before we went on the air today, Dr. Publicker, you told me that for this problem has been out there for years. It was just quiet. It was kept under the radar. And only recently has it become part of the public conversation. But one could say the same thing about sexual abuse, and they're linked.
Well, I think sexual abuse is still hidden. Society hasn't felt comfortable bringing it out. We've identified some more public folks that have been engaged in this. But it's a pervasive problem. Obviously, if 100% we're thinking of people who became drug addicted have been the victims of molestation in childhood. And I think most of us who are family physicians can also report that many people who have diverse medical problems, complaints, pains themselves with that addiction have been the victims of abuse.
Jennifer, difficult for primary care doctors to untangle that, to figure that out, especially when you're talking 20-minute appointments with patients?
Meaning if they've had an abuse history, is that?
Well, yeah. I mean, all of this, an abuse history. I suspect, Amanda, when you visited your doctor the first time, you didn't say, oh, by the way, I'm buying OxyContin illegally.
Right. I feel that most of our referrals, so we don't, if people call our office looking for help because they know that that's what we do at our office, we refer them to Crooked River first. So they all come kind of screened to us with a little bit of background in history. You know, mental, physical, sexual abuse is part of my screening tool with a patient that's there for the first time. That's something that we talk about. And I kind of feel like Catherine and I were talking about this on the way here, that sometimes you almost feel like this is a community approach. And we've been talking about kind of social things. And I think one of the reasons our office works so well is that everyone from the person that answers the phone to the doc to everyone else that supports them really engages in their treatment. And I think sometimes just treating these patients respectfully is a big part of their treatment. And sometimes just a little comment or something at the pharmacy or by another someone on the phone, you know, can almost cause a relapse or setback in their treatment. Maybe just because they haven't grown up in that, you know, home situation where they had a lot of support, and just giving them support is really beneficial.
All right. Well, Miriam, thank you for the question that started this line of the conversation. We're going to move on now to Felix, who is calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Well, hi. A question. When an addict gets to that point where they're heroin, when they're shooting just to maintain, and not necessarily get high, but to avoid the pain if they shut off, excuse me, is it possible to, under ideal conditions, the addict wants to quit and the dosages are prescribed, is it possible to wean them off that amount of heroin successively by lower and lower dosages instead of using methadone or whatever?
Addiction is characterized by a overwhelming compulsion to use a substance coupled with a loss of ability to inhibit the impulse to use. The same is true for alcohol. The same is true for any substance. Once addiction has occurred, the compulsion remains. The compulsion is overwhelming. And the brain's capacity to inhibit, to resist the compulsion is absent. So the answer is no. Using a substance itself triggers the need, the desire to use more. The more the negative experience that a person has in using, the more the compulsion will be to use.
Thanks for your question, Felix. We're going to move on to Mark. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Pavlikar. Mark, you mentioned earlier that the difference between inpatient care and outpatient care, and maybe that really inpatient care can put them at, I can't remember the exact term you used, but at a disadvantage. So I'm the parent of a child who just entered a detox facility on this past Friday, and she's scheduled to enter a rehab facility, a 30-day program to start with after that. Now, my opinion, or for lack of knowledge on this whole subject, is that I feel much better knowing my daughter is safe where she's in a detox facility right now, and she will be in a rehab, removed from a situation where there's so much heroin and opiates around on the street. So how can you elaborate on how the outpatient care is an advantage over inpatient care?
Essentially, when people leave a 30-day residential treatment program and are not provided with medication to help sustain, develop recovery, the risk of relapse is enormous. The residential treatment programs universally refuse and deny and are actually opposed to the use of medication. It's possible to be in a residential treatment program and during that time not be exposed to cues, not being exposed to people in the community. But upon return, the risk of relapse is enormously high. So a combination of the two is great. It's a good idea. Parents certainly are able to sleep better, and I really do appreciate that because the inability of parents to sleep when their child is actively addicted is horrible. But 30 days does not cure opiate addiction, and I think that's the most important thing to understand.
Mark, do you know if the facility your daughter has gone to, what its philosophy is about medication-assisted treatment?
Well, the detox facility, for example, they're tapering her on Suboxone, I guess, and the rehab facility, no, they don't. But it's, you know, the fact that this gives us as a family some time to plan for some care after the 30-day stint, whether it's 30, 60, or 90 days, actually, whatever it may be, I understand she probably has a lifelong battle now to deal with. But it can give us some time to try to find some aftercare in that way. But I guess I'm looking at it as an advantage right now, the rehab for us, as buying some time.
All right. And Amanda, I think, had some thoughts for you.
Yeah. I was going to say, I really, if while she's in there and you guys are planning an aftercare type deal, I think that would be awesome. I mean, it could work. But I also wanted to say that I went to a 30-day rehab, and when I got out, I was using again within 2 weeks. Then when I got on Suboxone, I've been clean ever since. I mean, it's not just getting on Suboxone or methadone. There's a lot more to it. You know, I started off going to a partial hospitalization thing, which was like 6 hours a day for 2 weeks, and then, you know, two groups a week, and it's a lot, but it's all, I mean, all of it together does help.
Let me just say, Mark, that I certainly understand support and think it's a great idea for your daughter. The challenge is that if that's universal, then with it's a zero-sum game. Either the money's going in one place or it's going in another. And it's not scalable.
Mark, thank you for your call, and good luck to you, your family, your daughter. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. We're going to move on to Franklin, Linwood, who's calling from Franklin. Hi, Linwood. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. How are you doing, Jennifer? Thank you very much for taking my call. What my concern is that I've had a grandson that went through outpatient rehab, actually twice. Suboxone was being used, and frankly, you know, and the attitude about Suboxone was, well, it's you know, you're taking one addiction and taking on another one for an addiction. And I thought that at first, but it's not true. As far as I'm concerned, Suboxone is no different than taking a medication for diabetes or whatever. It's just simply necessary.
Absolutely.
For the people that have this illness. But my concern is the cost. Many of the people that I observed going through the outpatient program, because I went and visited once in a while, you know, they're economically deprived, many of them, and they're on they've been on the street, so to speak. Where do they get the $400 a month for the Suboxone is what I'd like to know.
Okay, Linwood, it's a great question. I think this will be a great question for Catherine and Jennifer, because I suspect a lot of your patients fit into this, or it's difficult to figure out. How is this paid for?
That is a really great question, and Linwood, thank you so much for what you said. It's awesome that you think of the medication-assisted treatment that way. So I know in our system, there is always a battle with funding, and I think that the most difficult situation that we come up with is a patient that has no coverage at all, and they may not have a job, and they have no pay source. Those are really, really difficult cases. For us as an agency, because we work with the Bridgeton Hospital's practices, we can encourage them to utilize free care through the hospital. So that way their doctor's appointments would be paid for. We know the clinical liaison for the company that manufactures Suboxone, and he can often get us discount prescription cards that we can give to our folks.
And I'm guessing that other parts of the state of Maine, there are similar programs in place. Is there, and we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask, is there a central place to find information for our listeners?
I would say, unfortunately, no. I would say that the evidence, by the way, just for cost effectiveness and clinical effectiveness of Suboxone is enormous.
Okay. Well, thank you, Linwood, for your call. A great way to end this program, this very interesting program. And thank you to all of you here. Amanda telling her story, recovering from opiate addiction. Dr. Mark Publicker, addiction treatment specialist, past president of the Northern New England Society of Addiction Medicine, Jennifer Smith with North Bridgeton Family Practice, and Catherine Bell, executive director of Crooked River Counseling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is MPBN.